Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Dave.
And we're back with more theory.
Yeah, we're progressing our pathophysiological series on coax stuff.
No.
Gonna let that one go, huh? But, and we've talked a bit about platelets and
did.
platelets is fun. And so we figured it would be helpful to get this smaller, but although different, right, section out on von Willebrand's disease. So we'll do a little review on von Willebrand's factor. We will recommend that you go back and, refresh on the normal physiology stuff. But we'll do a little review in the beginning here. And we'll dig into von Willebrand's disease, its subtypes, and laboratory testing associated with it. And Melissa's especially excited because she's very, very knowledgeable here.
I love Von
So
Willey. It's my
she loves
fave.
it. And I like it. I don't love it. Yeah, you might hear Melissa more than me for this lecture, but cool. So maybe we start with a wonderful artistic representation of a von Willebrand's molecule. So we're going to draw a cartoon of von Willebrand's, and there's, if I remember correctly, four main features we kind of want to highlight here that are going to be important in talking about the disease. And one thing to kind of keep in mind is that there are different lengths of von Willebrand factor, okay?
You want to
And
talk about that
so,
first?
yeah, sure. Sure. So physiologically, we have ultra large molecules of von Willebrand factor that are made in endothelial cells and megakaryocytes, right? Yeah. And stored in Weibull-Plaid bodies, right?
In endothelial
In
cells.
endothelial cells. And so there's a fascinating enzyme called ADAMTS TS13, whose physiological function is responsible for cutting our von Willebrand's factor into smaller sections. And so having variable length von Willebrand factor is very advantageous to physiology. We'll see some of these disorders where maybe that doesn't work so good. And so we get really long von Willebrand factor, which can cause pathologies and things like that. Did I miss anything?
No, but let me give you guys a fun fact. So von Willebrand's factor is actually synthesized with a propeptide molecule attached. So the pro-protein portion is cleaved and removed before von Willebrand's actually comes out and does its thing. So the propeptide portion is synthesized, basically attached to the molecule, and then it's detached, but they're still linked to one another. And the propeptide, they still don't know how much functionality it actually has once it's released and von Willebrand's factor, because once it's released it, they dissociate and the propeptide goes off, and you can measure it in the blood if you really want to, but the actual molecule is the one that we actually look at and see what it does. But the propeptide does have some functionality. They believe that it helps it move through the Golgi apparatus, and a lot of the folding happens in the more acidic portion of the Golgi, which is weird. That doesn't usually happen for proteins, but they believe the propeptide has a function in that. But when it's stored in the Weibull-Plaid bodies in endothelial cells or in the alpha granules of our platelets, it's stored with, still attached to the propeptide. And then, so once you release it from either storage location, that's when they dissociate and the propeptide goes off and just circulates. And then you have the actual molecule for ADAMTS13 to chop up into the small, medium, and large molecular weight multimers. So the propeptide is actually a really interesting, I think it's a really cool, interesting portion because it's so weird. It just is there and then it's gone, and it doesn't actually have a huge function once you release it.
Sure.
The other thing that's cool about storage about von Willey is that the circulating levels of von Willebrand's comes from the endothelial cells, and the ones that's stored in the alpha granules are more of like that rapid release during times of coagulation when you actually need it. So really circulating levels, the reference intervals that we think about, excuse me, for von Willi are really from endothelial cells. Okay, so now we've got von Willi and we want to draw it.
Yeah, so there are lots of there's four different domains of the von Willebrand factor that are quite important to physiological function. They're call back to other things. So one of the interesting physiological functions of von Willebrand factor is that it binds factor VIII. I think that that's worth mentioning off the top here. So factor VIII is very, very labile and breaks down quite quickly when not paired with von Willebrand factor. So von Willebrand factor has this one receptor. Main job is to carry, be a carrier for VIII and sort of preserve its lengthen its half-life. Another really important function of von Willebrand factor is binding to platelet 1B95. It's probably one of the most important pieces of the von Willebrand factor. Von Willebrand factor also has the ability to bind with 2B3A, if memory serves me. And then the last domain, oh geez. So last domain is really important too, right? So we can see it now has a couple of different areas to grab onto platelets. Well, gee whiz, should be able to grab onto collagen, right? To really facilitate its function. So then it has receptors for our subendothelial collagen that's exposed when we have injury. So we want to keep this in mind, that these four domains are integral to the physiology. And then as we dig into the patho, we'll see that some of these domains might be affected in some way, right? And produce some kind of disease. Anything you'd like to expand on with those receptors?
No.
All right. Okay, so the next piece is just kind of go through the different von Willebrand's diseases. Is that fair?
So, because we
So,
talked about the propeptide and the subunit, and we talked about how it's released. Yeah, I think we can go right into the different diseases.
right, cool. So this is where it gets a little bit confusing, all right? And I'm gonna go through, so I thought about doing one, three, and then the twos, or should we go sequential one, two, threes? I
Doesn't
don't know.
matter. Whatever you'd like.
So I'm going to do it this way, and it might be a little unorthodox, but there's a little bit of rationale here, just a little bit. But the von Willebrand's disease type 1, okay, is typically, so is a quantitative disorder of von Willebrand factor. So these individuals have less circulating von Willebrand factor than normal, and so then they have decreased ability to for primary hemostasis, right? There is a subtype now, so this is new to me even. Okay, so we do have a subtype of 1C. So 1C is fascinating in that there's a mutation involved that affects the half-life of the von Willebrand factor. Pretty interesting, right? So presumably, these folks produce normal amounts, but because it doesn't last as long, well, you have a decreased circulating quantity. So, pretty neat. So, I would imagine both 1 and 1C both present similar pathophysiology. 1C diagnostically is only through molecular testing. So, we're looking for very specific mutations. What else can we add? Should we talk about the testing scheme? here too.
Well, so you said that type 1C is a decreased half-life issue. What's
Yes.
type 1, just in
So
general,
type
not
one would
1C?
be very good. Yeah, thank you. So type one would be a decreased production. So, and I always kind of look at it as like, there's going to be, so we're going to have lots of different genotypes, presumably, to present with this phenotype of type one. But these folks roughly have what, half the circulating von Willebrand factor than we would expect for them.
Yeah,
So they have
so
very mild.
with type 1, the interesting thing is most patients are going to be type 1.
Yeah.
And so when we look at type 1, there's so many different genetic mutations that are associated with just generically type 1 that molecular testing is actually not beneficial for type 1. But for 1C, that's how you diagnose it. So that's a newer thing. You need molecular testing for, well, you don't need it, but it's good to diagnose it for type 3 and some of the type 2 variants. But a lot of them you can do through the laboratory testing that we have. But for 1C, we actually need to know that it's a particular genetic mutation.
So for most of these, they're diagnosable with what we'd call a von Willebrand screening protocol, which is usually a bucket of tests. Von Willebrand's antigen, von Willebrand's activity, and typically we pair this with a factor VIII. So generally speaking, what we see in testing for ones is that we have decreased antigen and decreased activity. So those correlate with one another, given the mild, moderate bleeding.
So just back up 1 second. So antigen is just looking at how much von Willebrand's
Correct.
do you have. The activity is looking specifically at the functionality of von Willebrand's to bind to glycoprotein 1B. So
Right.
it's, if you think back to here, all of the functionality of von Willebrand's, the activity assays, whether it be like risdiplam cofactor assay, which is a platelet aggregation based assay, or a latex rapid assay that most institutions would use now, that would be just looking at its ability to bind to platelet receptor glycoprotein 1B95. So it's not looking at any of the other functionalities. So if you need further functionality testing, that's more of specialty. Well, I guess it depends on where you work, right? We used to work at a special coag lab where we performed routine screens and some specialty testing, and the rest got sent out. But a lot of this is going to be something that, like, you're going to have to do push to a send out lab. And then a lot of the further specialty testing is definitely going to be something that you need from a send out lab.
So,
So activity, von Willebrand's factor activity is only looking at glycoprotein 1B9 binding ability of von Willebrand's factor to that receptor, and then factor VIII. So you said for type 1 that the von Willebrand's factor antigen is decreased.
yes,
Activity is going to be
decreased.
decreased. But it's going to be a commensurate or comparable decrease. So they're all going to be about the same. And then factor VIII is also going to be decreased again, comparatively with this. And the decrease is very borderline. The challenge with type 1 von Willebrand's disease is that the levels of the reference intervals for von Willebrand's disease. Now we're going to get into a whole different bag of worms. So a lot of the reference intervals that are still being used are based off of ABO blood group, and those were established in 1987. That's the year I was born, guys. That's old, man. So those reference intervals weren't fantastic. They had some issues, but now I know a lot of guidelines are kind of giving like 30% is a hard cutoff for like you have disease. 30 to 50% is it's variable, and anything greater than 50% is not von Willebrand's. So it really depends on the reference intervals that the institution is using to identify disease or not disease. So a lot of times when you're dealing with type one, regardless of if it's one or 1C, the levels are really borderline, which makes it really challenging to diagnose. And von Willebrand's disease is one of those diseases that you don't just want to screen for. So physicians shouldn't just be screening. There should be a family history of mucocutaneous bleeding or a patient history of mucocutaneous bleeding because of that variability within the von Willebrand's levels. Because what if, a physician orders a von Willebrand screen on a patient and they don't have bleeding symptoms? Their family didn't have any history of it, but their levels are 35%. Is that von Willebrand's disease? Or is that sufficient for the patient? So that's.
Yeah, and there could be variable physiological conditions that might
Yes.
influence a von Willebrand factor level too. So, yeah.
Right. Well, we do know that blood group does influence it because of where the ABO blood groups bind. They bind onto the end-linked oligosaccharides that are on the molecule. I told you I was going to mention the end-linked oligosaccharides. So they like to bind onto those molecules on von Willebrand's, and that blocks some of the cleavage sites. So group O is going to have faster clearance of von Willebrand's factor as compared to group A, B, and AB. But is it significant enough? Does it really? How big of an influence is it? So anyway, it depends on the reference intervals that the institution is using. But the von Willebrand screen results are usually borderline low. So they're
I think
not like
it's,
blatantly in your face low.
yeah, I think it's fair to say that we're going to talk about the diagnostic scheme in a bit black and white terminology, but it's a lot more nuanced and variable in the clinical setting, definitely. Yeah. But like generally, right, and broadly,
Generally, yes, these are
yeah, you have
low.
decreased antigen mean decreased quantity, and then the activity is by the similar magnitude
Yes.
decreased, right? And then a similar magnitude decrease from there. It's a classic sort of presentation of one.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm gonna jump ahead to type three. So type three is a quantitative disorder of von Willebrand's. But it's profoundly decreased. So the difference between one and three is just the severity, more or less, right? So these folks will have almost no or no detectable Willebrand's factor activity and very, very low factor eight, owing to the poor half-life of factor eight when unbound from von Willebrand factor.
Yeah.
And so I
And
wish we could close the book there.
so with type three, these are typically specific mutations. A lot of times they're associated with families, although, there can be new mutations as well. But these are very obvious mutations, obvious severities, obvious bleeds, significantly larger bleeds as compared to type one. So patients with type one are going to be more of the heavy menses, the easy bruising, the nosebleeds, the gums bleed. Whereas type three is going to be because of that factor eight being so decreased, they're going to have similar symptoms to hemophiliacs.
So yeah, these two I found as a student and now a teacher to be pretty straightforward. And I skipped over two, right? So now, so type one and three, I want you to frame as quantitative issues with von Willebrand factor. And for type two, we're now moving into qualitative disorders. So there are four subtypes of two, right? So let me get my reading material here. So first is type 2A. So type 2A is These particular molecules of von Willebrand factor are more susceptible to ADAMTS TS13's enzymatic activity. So what does that mean, right? So if we imagine as a analogy of ADAMTS TS13's job is to just kind of cut up, I imagine like scissors cutting up, a roll of tape, right? And so with 2A, the scissors are much easier to, they're more active and much easier, or I should say the tape is more susceptible to the scissors. And so you get smaller pieces of von Willebrand factor.
Think of it
So
as like
this,
if with cutting, if you're cutting paper versus you're cutting wrapping paper, like Christmas wrapping paper. When
yeah.
you cut Christmas wrapping paper, you're like, then it's gone. When
Just
you cut paper, you actually got to try to cut the
kind of
paper.
work through it a bit. Yeah. So with these particular patients, they have very, very small multimers present. Okay. And so this kind of feeds into, we're going to talk about multimer testing and things like that. But because the pieces are so small, they have more of a bleeding diathesis because the smaller pieces of von Willebrand factor, it doesn't offer very much space for platelets to bind to. Can platelets bind to them? Yes, absolutely. But given that they're smaller, it doesn't have the same oomph impact in the primary hemostasis.
Yeah, so it's either a genetic mutation of increased proteolysis breakdown by ADAMTS TS13 or abnormal multimer assembly while they're actually being created. So during the actual making process, it's one of the two, but it's going to result in the same thing where you get a loss of your high molecular weight multimers and your intermediate molecular weight multimers. So when we look at our lab testing, right, we've got our antigen, our activity, and our factor eight. Our antigen is going to be normal, maybe a little bit low. Our activity is going to be low. And then
But
our
this is
factor
where
eight
the
is
scheme,
normal.
yeah. So this is where the scheme really, really matters in differentiating like a one and such. So now the activity will be significantly decreased relative to any possible decrease in the antigen, right?
Yes.
So hey, the antigen's a little low, the activity is way low.
Yes. That's where you know it's a two and you know you got to do more testing.
Yeah.
Anytime you look at the activity and it doesn't match the antigen, you got to do more testing.
Yeah. And so a typical follow-up protocol here would probably be to do a multimer.
Multimers, yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's an electrophoretic procedure. Is that correct? So, a lot of
SPS
places this is a
page, gel
send-out.
electrophoresis, it'll be sent out and they'll just do gel electrophoresis and see which multimers are present. So there should be high, intermediate, and low molecular weight multimers. And so if you see the loss of the high molecular weight and intermediate molecular weight, that's 2A.
Shakespeare joke in here, but I'll leave it alone. Next we have 2B.
Or not to be.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
So subtype 2B is pretty fascinating. So 2B is classified physiologically as a gain of function, right? So in this particular variant, the binding site for 1B95 works too well. And so what ends up happening is the high molecular weight multimers, the bigger pieces that are normally present, are spontaneously binding platelets and being consumed. So this is problematic. This decreases the amount available for normal physiological primary hemostasis and can also consequently cause so-called white clots, right, to form in microvasculature and things. So this can be a little bit more dangerous. So we've been talking about these have like more of a bleeding proclivity, and then this one's kind of a mix of both where you can have clots, inappropriate clot formations, things like that. So really, really neat. Now, moving on to testing for this, right? As I understand it, activity antigen will be quite variable here and probably not tell you a lot.
Yeah, so antigen is usually normal. The activity is variable and factor VIII should be normal. But if you're looking at a von Willebrand's patient with thrombocytopenia, or a possible von Willebrand's patient with thrombocytopenia, that's where you're probably starting to think more. Hey, remember the other time when we talked about our platelet disorders and I talked about Bernard Soulier having thrombocytopenia and some von Willis have it? So this
Absolutely.
is the subtype of von Willis that has thrombocytopenia. Not usually giant platelets, but just thrombocytopenia. Who knows how severe the disease process is? Maybe you could see giant platelets, but really it's this weird activity again probably will not match the antigen, and that's and so if your antigen is normal and your activity is normal
Normal high, maybe even.
or abnormal low. So yeah, because abnormal, that's right, because we're looking at activity in the relationship to glycoprotein 1b, so this might be even high. But there's actually, so you could do multimers, right? So you'd see the loss of the high molecular weight multimers, but there's the ricin-induced platelet aggregation assay that we could do as well. So we call it a RIPA, ricin-induced platelet aggregation. So first step for RIPA is, let's think back. So if you're wondering about platelet aggregation, Dave and I talked about how to perform that in the talk that we did about the platelet disorders, where we talked about Glanzmann's and Bernard Soulier. So you would perform a regular platelet aggregation first, and then you would perform a ricin-induced platelet aggregation, which is basically just you're performing the same platelet aggregation assay, but with varying concentrations of ricin. So if you have 1500 nanograms of ricin, you might do 1200, 1000, 900, 500, 300 for your concentrations, something like that. You're going in decreasing concentrations. Normal individuals, being patients with normal platelets, normal von Willebrands, would have no reactivity once you get to lower levels of ricin because there's not enough ricin to induce the von Willebrands to agglutinate with the glycoprotein 1b. However, if you're a type 2b patient, even at small concentrations of risto, it's enough to induce that interaction between the von Willebrands and glycoprotein 1b. So you do get agglutination at low concentrations of ricin, whereas normal individuals don't. So ricin-induced platelet aggregation is something that can be done for a type 2b to test for it.
But 2B is kind of a tricky one. Is and it yeah,
Yeah, it's a little different.
it's a bit different than von Willebrand's disease. It's probably the most well, yeah. There's other weirdos too, I guess.
Yeah,
So,
von Willebrand's disease is just interesting in
yeah, the
general.
twos are like what? But yeah, so that I think that's pretty good description of 2B. Subtype 2M. M as in Mike. So this, the von Willebrand's disease, we have an issue with platelet receptor binding. So now we have otherwise normal von Willebrand's that doesn't bind platelets particularly well. And so if you run the von Willebrand screening protocol here, you have normal antigen with decreased activity. So this is where the schema kind of is interesting. So looking at the ratio and magnitudes of like decreases, so you'll have profoundly decreased activity relative to the antigen concentration.
Well, the other thing that's important to know is that if you were to do multimer analysis, multimers are normal.
Good point.
And that is, multimer analysis is pretty important when we're talking about type twos. So if you have normal multimers, you're not dealing with a loss of these multimers. This one is just, you have decreased affinity for binding to glycoprotein 1B.
So that one's pretty somewhat
That one's
straightforward.
easy. Okay.
Yeah, that's an easy one. The next one's kind of neat too. So this is 2N, and the N standing for Normandy variant. So with Willebrand's disease 2N, there's a mutation in the domain that binds our factor VIII. So this is really cool. These individuals look like a hemophiliac, right? So they have very similar presentation of a factor VIII deficiency. Only the problem here is that because they don't have that binding site, factor VIII is being produced in normal quantities as opposed to someone with a true factor VIII deficiency. But it's not serving as the carrier molecule. The von Willebrand's is not serving as the carrier molecule to our factor VIII. And so the half-life of factor VIII drastically reduces, and so does concentrations. So these folks would have normal antigen, normal activity. It's funny because the presentation, it's not a von Willebrand. So this might not go on the von Willebrand, like the differential diagnosis, because it doesn't really look like a true von Willebrand disease. But you'd have normal antigen, normal activity, decreased factor VIII, right? And so, geez, how do you even diagnose these?
Yeah, so some
Normal.
differences, like for example, hemophilia is going to impact males. So
That's fair, right?
if you
Yeah.
have a female patient who presents with this, it's type 2N.
Yep.
For
It's just.
males, you are going to have to do more testing. So some hem-onc docs may go straight to doing like factor VIII genetic tests just to make sure. And if not, then they could move to doing more of the genetic tests associated with type 2N for von Willebrand's disease. The other thing is you're going to find out really quick when you try to treat him. So if
Yeah.
you try to treat a patient and you try to give him factor VIII infusions, that's not going to do anything because you can't carry it.
Yep. So, whereas a patient that's just deficient in factor VIII will respond generally, because that's another can of worms, right? Where the antibody formation and things like that. But when you treat a traditional factor VIII patient, you give them factor VIII, that resumes normal physiology. With these individuals, that's not going to be so. And the thing to understand too, the text here I'm referencing, less than 5% of patients have this type of von Willebrand disease. So it's rare, but you got to know this stuff, right?
Well, in like the so it I guess it depends on where you work too, because if you work in a larger metropolitan level one where you deal with hem-onc docs and you deal with these populations, 5% that you may see that more common, much more commonly. I mean, I've
That's
seen
true.
all of the subtypes of von Willebrand's disease multiple times. So though these, some of these subtypes are rare. But they're not on Glanzmann's or Bernard Soulier rare level. Those are like really rare, and you'll probably never see those.
Right.
So it really
Well,
does vary.
yeah. So that's von Willebrand's as I know it anyway.
Well, I think there's a couple other things to consider with von Willebrand's disease
Sure.
because remember, von Willebrand's factor is a positive acute phase reactant.
Oh, excellent point.
So
So
anytime you have inflammation, von Willebrand's is increased. Von Willebrand's and factor VIII and fibrinogen, they're all positive acute phase reactants. So anytime you have inflammation, von Willebrand's is increased. So you don't want to measure von Willebrand's disease in a patient who has inflammation. It's
It
increased.
gets really complicated, right? In terms of, yeah.
So you don't want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, because I suppose someone who's like a traditional or type one in an inflammatory condition, diagnosis there is going to be really, really difficult, if not
Really tough.
impossible.
Yeah, the type twos and threes, I mean, they're going to be really pretty straightforward. Like, those are not, though, it's the type ones, and that's the majority of the patients. They're type ones. So, you don't want to have the patients having inflammation. Again, depending on where, what in the institution uses for reference intervals, it may vary by blood type, which then you have to, keep track of that. The other thing that, and this is really for physicians to monitor, but physicians need to know where a woman is in her menstruation cycle to know, is she actively bleeding? Is she not? Where are you? Because the von Willebrand levels increase and decrease depending on where a woman is in her menstruation cycle. So that's another important piece, really more for the physician, but something to take into consideration is physicians need to, if it's a von Willi patient or potential patient, and they need to do, maybe it's a type one and they got a level on a patient and they want to get in the level on again on a patient a different time, you should probably do it during the same cycle, part of the cycle, so that you can have consistent levels. What else for considerations with von Willi?
I defer.
I don't know that there's much else. I think that's it for von Willi. And then I guess treatment, but we wouldn't really be involved in treatment. So treatment, you could give DDAVP.
Desmopressin, right?
Yeah. Well, DDAVP is like something like 1-desamino-arginine vasopressin or something interesting like that. And then we call it desmopressin because it acts on vasopressin receptors. So the V1, vasopressin receptors, desmopressin acts on and causes the release of von Willebrand from the Weibel-Palade bodies. So we could use DDAVP as a treatment option, but physicians need to do a DDAVP challenge. So
Their action
essentially,
response.
yeah, to make sure that someone actually responds to DDAVP for treatment, because you don't want to find out that they don't respond in surgery. You want to know beforehand. So basically, a DDAVP challenge would be that the patient would come in, you would draw baseline levels, and then you give the patient DDAVP. And then you measure the von Willebrand screen levels at half an hour, an hour, and then 2 or 3 hours later. And essentially, the von Willebrand screen, so the von Willebrand's antigen activity and factor VIII level, should all jump 2 to 3 times what the normal base level is. If they are a responder, and if they are a responder, that means you can treat them with DDAVP. And if they're not, that means you can't treat them with DDAVP, and you'd have to go to other products to treat the patient.
Also good to note the 2B variant, the gain of function, it's not indicated to use.
You would use other things for that because we don't want to. So DDAVP causes the patient to release their own von Willebrands from endothelial cells, and you don't, and when you're a type 2B, you don't want to release your gain of function von Willi from your endothelial cells. That's why it's not indicated.
Yeah, drastically increase the risk of thrombosis and like that.
So DDAVP is a good option for type ones. Some of the other subtypes, but I mean, if you think about like subtype 3, if my baseline level is 5%, is 2 to 3 times that really going to make an impact?
It's probably
No.
not. Yeah.
So you'd have to go to like concentrate products for those sorts of patients. I mean, cryo precipitate, but most patients, most institutions, at least in industrialized countries, don't really use cryo precipitate. They're going to go more towards the recombinant products to reduce the exposure to other human products. I guess you could also give like antifibrinolytic agents too, like aminocaproic acid to prevent fibrinolysis from, or delay fibrinolysis. You don't want to fully prevent it, but you want to delay it to give the clot a good amount of time to really form. And those antifibrinolytics are usually used in conjunction with like DDAVP or those other products. I mean, sometimes these products, recombinant products, are in the blood bank. So if you're a blood banker, you may be, given out those products. So I think that'll vary, whether that's the pharmacy or the actual lab that gives out the product. Otherwise, I mean, I can talk about all the fun stuff about genetics with von Willebrand's disease. I can tell you everything you didn't want
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
to know. Yeah, but I think that was a good overview of all of the stuff about Von Willy.
I think so too. Yeah, I think for most folks, that'll be very practical, functional level of information to know.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool.
All right, well, that's all we've got for this one, so thanks for listening.
Thank you for your time.